Ready? Okay. Good morning. Please join us in our first hymn, number 188, Come, Come, Whoever You Are. Beautiful. I'd like to welcome you this morning, this day, and this opportunity to be together in community. This fellowship is a place where we come to learn more about being human. We're not here because we figured out life's questions or because we think we've got it right. We've come here to learn more about being in a relationship together, how to listen, how to forgive, how to be vulnerable, and how to create trust and compassion in one another. My name is J.C. Hamm, and I'm your convener for today, not Chris Bailey, as it says in your announcement. And I'm so glad to see all of you here this brand new morning in this brand new world as we gather together in peace. The joyful, the heartbroken, atheists and Christians, Muslims and Jews, straight and gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, all who are searching, seeking, looking for more meaning, more service, and more love. I'd like to welcome any guests we have here today. Thank you for taking a chance and taking the time to walk through our doors and join us in being authentic with each other, honest within ourselves, and opening to connection in all of its forms. Please refer to your order of service for a detailed list of announcements. If you haven't already, please sign the guest book in the narthex after the service if you're visiting today. I would also remind people that if you have a joy or sorrow, to fill out a card on the table in the narthex, and we'll collect those before our joys and concerns. John Alou had one announcement that her Radina hours are changed. She'll be in Aggieville from 2 to 4 on Saturday. Stop by after the parade. And then in the announcements, that Easter potluck brunch, that's exciting, the St. Patrick's Day Parade, and then we have a little box out in the narthex for the toiletries and personal care products, if you can remember to bring those sooner than later. And then Mark would like to come up and share one announcement as well.
Yeah, good morning, Mark Clark. I sent an email out to the group, the Yahoo group, regarding a survey that I mentioned a few months ago now, on discussing having two services versus just one. Take a look at your email. If you don't have ready access to a computer, I do have my computer here today, and I will next week as well, before and after the service. So, if you don't have ready access to a computer, you can fill out that survey using my computer. So, thanks very much.
All right, we will now light the chalice while listening to two beautiful pieces. Everything Begins on the Verge of Awareness by George Kimmich Beach. Everything begins on the verge of awareness. The dawn is now, not and then is. Sleep is and then is not. In between the awakening, the passage of thin light between breaks open the day. The passage of thin sound between flows into the day. Too soon the numbing rumble of traffic swells, the day glares. Let the soft haze hang again across the row of morning. Wait upon the narrow moment, the first awareness of being in between. Live days and seasons on thin edge of dawn and praise that every single thing begins now. Please stand as you're able for hymn number 312 here on the paths of every day.
Thank you. Good morning. I hope everybody found a place in the parking lot. A few times every year, we welcome new members into our fellowship. We had a lovely breakfast this morning with some of the new members, as well as some people who have been visiting with us, and that was lots of fun. So today we welcome three new members, and I'm going to invite them to come up. George Johnson, whose wife Patty joined us last fall. The military brought them here, and they bring their daughters Violet and Virginia. Kim Ewing has visited with us off and on for years, and so we're happy to welcome her as a new member. And Sabra Tieperman has recently moved to town for a new job, and she's known Lori Cross for a long time. So it's nice to welcome them. Membership in this fellowship is simple because all that's required is to sign our membership book. We hold no creed. Nothing need be recited. Membership in a UU congregation, though, is difficult because you've joined a community searching for truth when truth can be elusive. Membership means you're part of a congregation struggling for justice, knowing that the struggle can be long. And membership means that you've joined with a people who strive to live in loving relationship with each other. And these are not easy things. So, do you, the new members of this congregation, freely enter into membership in this congregation?
Yes.
And to the gathered congregation, each new face and each new voice that joins with us brings with them their sorrows and joys, their skills and abilities, their thoughts and beliefs. With every new member, we become a new congregation. Do you accept these persons into membership fully aware that the nature of this religious body is evolving?
We do.
Oh, that was so nicely said. We then accept you fully into our ranks and formally extend to you the sincere welcome of our fellowship, mindful of the bond which already exists between us and the hope of that bond growing stronger each day. And I'm going to ask you to introduce yourselves to the congregation again on the microphone so they can all hear you, and to light a tea light from the chalice, a symbol of your connection with us and the inspiration we hope you will receive from the connection you make this morning. And while we're doing all that, Shirley's going to present symbols of that bond.
I'm George Johnson.
I'm Sabra Tieperman.
And I'm Kim Ewing.
Joining is but a beginning. We look forward to becoming a new and more diverse congregation thanks to the presence of each of our members, no matter how long you have been here. A time may come when the fellowship disappoints you, and a time may come when through action or inaction you fail the fellowship. And please know that the covenant between us offers the hope and miracle of healing as long as we stay in relation with each other. The power of covenant does not go so far as to say that it doesn't matter what happened, but it does assert that the hopeful truth that what is more important is what happens next. You are now part of us and we a part of you. May our days together be joyous. And I close our welcome with this reading from Rudy Nemser, Some of you who participate in chalice circles may recognize it as being in last month's packet on perseverance. It's very appropriate in welcoming people to membership because we hope that our new members will become long-haul people, and we hope we encourage all our existing members in that as well. Long-haul people, you find them in churches when you're lucky. Other places too, though I mostly know the ecclesiastical varieties. Long-haul people upon whose shoulders and pocketbooks and casseroles and daylight, nighttime hours a congregation is built and maintained after the brass is tarnished and the cushions need restitching. They pay their pledges full and on time even when the music's modern. Support each canvas through the though the sermons aren't always short. Mow lawns and come to suppers. Teach Sunday school when no one else will, and they'll miss the service. Asked what they think of the minister or plans for the kitchen renovation or the choral anthem or the Christmas pageant or color of the bathroom paint, they'll reply, "Individuals and fashions arrive and pass." The church, their church, will be here, steady and hale, for a long time. A long, long time. It will. For long-haul people, bless a congregation with a very special blessing.
I would like to say thank you to Dick Beeman and Rob Long for sharing their talent with us today. They have... And Sylvia. Hey. They have prepared a musical piece called Heaven's Already Here, written by a duo called Collective Soul.
How many of you guys have heard of Collective Soul before? This is a band that was kind of big in the late 1990s. It was really a rock band, but this is a beautiful love song nonetheless. Peace of mind.
head.
Was fantastic. Thank you. All right. I would like to invite all the children, if you're wanting, to come to the front for the story of all ages. Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. All right. I'm going to do this just a little bit different today. I'm going to read a story called The Three Questions, based on a story by Leo Tolstoy. Has anyone heard of Leo Tolstoy? You will in the next couple years, I'm sure. It's written and illustrated by John Muth. And the way I'm going to do it different today is because after this, we're just going to take a moment to think about what the story is about. And then we're going to be done. We're not going to talk about it because the message in this story is in the story. Cool? Cool. All right. There once was a boy named Nikolai who sometimes felt uncertain about the right way to act. "I want to be a good person," he told his friends, "but I don't always know the best way to do that." Nikolai's friends understood, and they wanted to help him. "If only I could find the answers to my three questions," Nikolai continued, "then I would always know what to do." When is the best time to do things? Who is the most important one? What is the right thing to do? Nikolai's friends considered his first question. Then Sonia the heron spoke. "To know the best time to do things, one must plan in advance," she said. Gogol the monkey, who had been rooting through some leaves to find something to eat, said, "You will know when to do things if you watch and pay close attention." Then Pushkin the dog, who was just dozing off, rolled over and said, "You can't pay attention to everything yourself. You need a pack to help watch you decide when to do things. For example, Gogol, a coconut is about to fall on your head." Nikolai thought for a moment. Then he asked his second question. "Who is the most important one?" "Those who are closest to heaven," said Sonia, circling into the sky. "Those who know how to heal the sick," said Gogol, stroking his bruised noggin. "Those who make the rules," grouted Pushkin. Nikolai thought some more. Then he asked his third question. "What is the right thing to do?" "Flying," said Sonia. "Having fun all the time," laughed Gogol. "Fighting," barked Pushkin right away. Then the boy thought for a long while. He loved his friends. He knew they were all trying their best to help him answer his questions, but their answers just didn't seem quite right. Then an idea came to him. "I know," he thought. "I will ask Leo the turtle. He has lived a very long time. Surely he will know the answers I'm looking for." You're right. They can live up to 100 years, I think. Good thought. Nikolai hiked up high into the mountains where the old turtle lived all alone. When Nikolai arrived, he found Leo digging in a garden. The turtle was old, and digging was hard for him. "I have three questions I came to ask your help," Nikolai said. "When is the best time to do things? Who is the most important one? What is the right thing to do?"
"That's great. And they're all backwards,"
Leo listened carefully, but he only smiled. Then he went on with his digging. You must be tired, Nikolai said at last. Let me help you, the turtle gave him his shovel and thanked him. And because it was easier for a young boy to dig than it was for an old turtle, Nikolai kept on digging until the rows were finished. But just as he finished, the wind blew wildly and rain burst from darkened clouds. As they moved toward the cottage for shelter, Nikolai suddenly heard a cry for help. Running down the path, he found a panda whose leg had been injured from a fallen tree. Carefully, Nikolai carried her into Leo's house and made a splint for her leg with a stick of bamboo. The storm raged on, banging at the doors and windows. The panda woke up. Where am I? She said. And where is my child? The boy ran out of the cottage and down the path. The roar of the storm was deafening. Pushing against the howling wind and drenching rain, he ran further into the forest. Then he found the panda's child, cold and shivering on the ground. The little panda was wet and scared, but alive. Nikolai carried her inside and made her warm and dry. Then he laid her in her mother's arms. Leo smiled when he saw what the boy had done. The next morning, the sun was warm, birds sang, and all was well with the world. The panda's leg was healing nicely, and she thanked Nikolai for saving her and her baby from the storm. At that moment, Sonia, Gogol, and Pushkin arrived to make sure everything was all right. Nikolai felt great peace within himself. He had wonderful friends, and he had saved the panda and the child. But he also felt disappointed. He still had not found the answers to his three questions, so he asked Leo one more time. The old turtle looked at the boy. But your questions have been answered, he said. They have? Asked the boy. Yesterday, if you had not saved to help me dig my garden, you wouldn't have heard the panda's cries for help in the storm. Therefore, the most important time was the time you spent digging the garden. The most important one at that moment was me, and the most important thing to do was to help me with my garden. Later, when you found the injured panda, the most important time was the time you spent mending her leg and saving her child. The most important ones were the panda and her baby. And the most important thing to do was to take care of them and make them safe. Remember then that there is only one important time, and that time is now. The most important one is always the one you are with, and the most important thing to do is the one who is standing at your side. For these, my dear boy, are the answers to what is most important in this world. This is why we are here. All right, I want you to close your eyes for just 10 seconds and think about that last little message about answering those three questions. Thank you. Our most important time is right now. All right.
Go in love.
All right. There's nothing more beautiful than someone who goes out of their way to make life beautiful for others. In the words of Carol Bellamy, in serving the best interests of children, we serve the best interests of all humanity. Please welcome Richard Pitts from our Wonder Workshop.
It's awesome to be here this morning. Thank you for that warm welcome. I certainly appreciate it. It's nice to see some old familiar faces that I haven't seen in a while, and some new faces, which is always nice too. I'm here to thank you for last year for helping us scholarship kids in our summer program called Think Big. Last year, we had additional help from different folks in the community, and we scholarshiped over 20 students to do our Think Big summer camps, which ran for a week-long, seven unique weeks. So this year, I am wanting to scholarship more than 20-some kids. We recently purchased a 12-passenger van to go along with our 15-passenger van and our 7-passenger van. And so we are hoping to scholarship at least 30 to 40 kids this year who are sitting home doing nothing, low-income students. We have plenty of those in our district. And last year it hurt to say no to some people, but this year I hope you will help us say yes to some people. This summer we'll be offering 7 different weeks. The first week is, and I have this flyer outside your doors here, we're studying birds with the help of people in our community, some folks from here. And the second week, we'll be doing insects. Last year, we had an entomologist by the name of, you may know him, Dick Beeman. Yeah, he came out with one of his friends from the university and enchanted us all. So we ain't got to do anything alone. We do things with the help of our community. We'll be studying frogs, reptiles, mammals, fish, and plants. We're going to get these kids out in nature. Instead of just seeing things on TV or doing this, that, and the other, they're going to be out in it, involved, learning, having fun, using art, science tools as a way to come closer to the outdoors. So there's less of a nature deficit disorder, according to Richard Love, in our community. So I will ask y'all to dig deep when that plate comes around to help us scholarship some kids. Last but not least, I want to draw attention to this poster that I'm going to leave here. And it's a I've been leading Underground Railroad tours since 1997. We have been sharing multicultural diversity in Manhattan since 1989, when we first formulated the Wonder Workshop Children's Museum through the arts, the sciences, and the humanities. This program will allow people to be immersed into a slavery experience, an Underground Railroad experience, and beyond that, be able to talk about how history is a current event, how those legacies from years gone by act out in our lives today. And it's a 3.5 to 4 hour program. We hope that you will look at this, consider it, become part of this, become part of the dialogue, and become part of the solution that's plaguing our community and many communities across the nation, especially when it comes to race and the Me Too movement and so many other movements out there. This is a time to come and share. Share because we need it, and our kids need it. I saw online the other day, and I'm going to get off of this platform here, that white parents are fearful of talking about race at home. Well, they're not talking about it at school. They're not talking about it hardly anywhere else except amongst friends. And probably they're getting the wrong information, these kids, when they're talking with friends. How are we going to build our world, make it a better place, if we don't do something? I'll leave it to you. Thank you.
We give to remind ourselves how many gifts we have to offer. We give to remember that we are part of something bigger than ourselves. We give because we believe in music and sacred space. We give with the faith that together we have enough. The offering will now be given and gratefully received. Thank you.
Renee. The joys and concerns that we share with one another build the bonds of community. We are sorry to hear that Ronan Tenona is homesick with both type A and type B flu. I didn't even know you could do that. I hope he'll be well soon. I have a joy from Jessica Severs, which I share with her. This Friday and Saturday, we went to the Beloved Conversations Workshop on Race Relations with Reverend John Alou, Harriet Yonke, Colleen Riley, J.C. Hamm, and Laura Roberson. We are excited to move forward in our endeavors to create a more beloved community, and you'll be hearing more about that. And from four-year-old Sean Devlin Hendon, I am happy to hear music. May we all be happy to hear music. It's a blessing in our lives.
To Savor the World or Save It by Richard Gilbert. I rise in the morning torn between the desire to save the world or to savor it, to serve life or to enjoy it, to savor the sweet taste of my own joy or to share the bitter cup of my neighbor, to celebrate life with exuberant step or to struggle for the life of the heavy laden. What am I to do with the guilt at my bounty clouds the sky of my vision, when the glow which lights my every day illumines the hurting world around me? To savor the world or save it? God of justice, if such there be, take me from the burden of my question. Let me praise my plentitude without limit. Let me cast from my eyes all troubled folk. No, you will not let me be. You will not stop my ears to the cries of the hurt and the hungry. You will not close my eyes to the sight of the afflicted. What is that you say? To save, one must serve. To savor, one must save. The one will not stand without the other. Forgive me in my preoccupation with myself, in my concern for my own life, I had forgotten. Forgive me, God of justice, forgive me and make me whole. And my mantra from Francis of Assisi, from Archene Turner, make me an instrument of peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. Where there is sadness, joy. Please stand as you're able for hymn number 341, O World, Thou Choosest Not the Better Part.
Thank you.
perhaps the most common symbol for justice is also a symbol of balance, the scales of justice. We often see the scales in the hand of Lady Justice balancing the arguments on either side of a court case. The origins of the symbol go back to ancient times. Caesar Augustus introduced the symbol as the goddess Justitia. But the woman with the scales goes back even further to ancient Egypt. Sometimes, since the Middle Ages, she's been depicted as blindfolded to symbolize the impartiality of the court. She's not real. She's the image of an ideal, the idea that somehow we can use a balance to come to justice. And I want to talk about a completely different kind of balance for justice. I am wondering how we add the pursuit of justice into a life that is already full. As overwhelmed as most of us are, adding a layer of justice doesn't work. Many of us have discovered this past year or so, as matters have felt more urgent with mass shootings, racist incidents like Charlottesville, erratic policymaking swings from the federal administration, anti-immigration crackdowns, the Me Too movement, war, voter suppression, and all in the midst of worsening climate change. I find myself returning again and again to this theme of overwhelm. And I've heard other ministers say the same thing. How do we do justice work in a balanced way in a crazy world? A way, though, where we can maintain the effort and still continue to live our lives to both save and savor the world. And though the issue has intensified in the last 18 months, we're not facing a wholly new dilemma. People have faced oppression and injustice since the beginning of time. And we seem to be on a trajectory that encourages a segmented life that makes justice work particularly challenging. Here are words from Common Fire, leading lives of commitment in a complex world. They write, during the period of our study, public concern grew about what has been called the coarsening of society, mounting violence on both street and screen, widespread anxiety about the changing patterns of family life and employment, increasing numbers of depressed adults and emotionally troubled children, the spread of AIDS, tuberculosis, and other infectious disease, increased concern about the adequacy of health care. We've seen growing economic disparity divide the global north from the global south, while at the same time cutting through the heart of our cities and carving up the rural landscape, tearing at long-standing racial wounds. Indeed, as we stand on new ethical frontiers, asking new questions about governance of the earth, exploration in space, and the harnessing of technology for the long-term benefit of the whole earth community, we also recognize that our major institutions, government, the news and entertainment media, corporations, the family, schools, and religion often seem unable to address the fundamental problems in positive and effective ways. That was published in 1996, 22 years ago. So I'm going to actually draw, though, a fair amount on this work. It's a study by a group of educators, two couples, Laurent A. Parks Dallas and Sharon Dallas Parks and Cheryl and James Keene. They interviewed more than 100 social activists who had maintained their work for a long time to discover what they had in common and how people can stay engaged in a balanced and sustainable way to work to do justice. They didn't include single-issue people or those engaged for a short period of time. the criteria of balance and sustainability show through even in their selection process. They put it this way. We sought out those who held strong convictions, yet were not fanatical, who had a clear focus, yet were not blind to other perspectives, who held a large and inclusive vision, yet were not simple idealists, and who, while working on behalf of a particular constituency, understood themselves to be working on behalf of the whole of life. So we hear that implicit advice on balance in doing justice, strong convictions, not fanatics, clear focus, able to see other perspectives. It's all a balancing thing, isn't it? Working for a particular group of people, but seeing your vision as really inclusive of the whole world, on behalf of the whole of life. I rather like that phrase, on behalf of the whole of life. On behalf of the whole of life. When I was working in community organizing, one of the things we did was to discern prospective leaders. And people who were passionate and focused on a single issue were considered leaders, but they weren't primary leaders. Not at least not until they could broaden their perspectives. And I cringe a bit at that judgment, but there's a useful idea here. Someone who focuses narrowly on a particular issue will have a challenge in growing a network of support and even in addressing the complexity of interlocking issues. For example, how is gun control related to racial justice? How do issues of education connect with criminal justice reform? How do gender inequity and racial inequity affect economic justice? Now, I've known many passionate single-issue people who've done a lot of good, but the best of them have a broader understanding and engagement, and that may be a starting point for balance in doing justice. So a broad perspective helps. Instead of seeing a host of niggling gnats that are separate issues and problems, we can see how all of these issues and problems are interconnected. And then when we tug at one of them over here, we can see effects over there. The interconnections matter. The complexity reminds me, though, that we have to include time and energy for reflection and for strategy. One of the most useful tools I know for balance and justice work is the action-reflection model. This makes us into justice learners as well as justice makers. Various strategies exist, but the essence is the same. We take action, and then we reflect on that action, learn what went well, what could have gone better. We modify the strategy, make a new plan, and act again. Rinse and repeat. There is no better way to learn how to make justice than to follow that simple plan. Act, reflect, act, reflect, act, reflect. And the bonus is you don't burn out as easily. We're doing two things that build in hope when we do that. We're recognizing and naming our successes, and we're learning along the way, which also gives us hope that we will keep doing better. On top of that, because we have that rhythm of not constantly pounding on the action, but taking a break to do something very different, to think, evaluate, strategize, we don't get as tired. Now, I'm not talking about getting stuck in thinking, evaluating, and learning, because that's also a way we can go wrong. We also take action, so we have something to reflect on. Now, in an emergency, we can do a lot for a short period of time. Human beings respond well to hurricanes and tornadoes. We rescue people, feed and house them, comfort them. The adrenaline's flowing, and we can go without sleep, grabbing inconsistent meals. What responders learn, though, is that there is a cycle to how disaster recovery goes. Immediately after, even for a long while, the response is strong, hope is there. And then as time goes by, the first responders are gone, the media's gone, the volunteers thin, and gradually there's a new normal, and then discouragement sets in. The recovery looks too long, too far. And I'm afraid we do social justice work that way sometimes, like recovery work. But think about Puerto Rico. 6 months after the hurricane, the urgency's gone, the effort cannot be maintained, yet 20% of Puerto Ricans still don't have electricity. Tens of thousands of blue tarps cover roofs. Recovery is slow. The Ninth Ward of New Orleans has yet to fully recover from Katrina in 2005. It's a new normal. And when that kind of new normal sets in, disaster response evaporates, we can end up with completely unjust and unacceptable situations. Places where anyone with enough privilege, whether it's connections elsewhere, education, money, resources, white skin, tends to desert the place, reinforcing the inequity and injustice. It's not just after disasters. We see it with white flight in public schools and neighborhoods. It's a dynamic that's tough to break. The point is, though, my point here is that frenetic initial response cannot be maintained. We cannot act like there is an emergency always, because that is not humanly sustainable. Even if we believe that justice is an emergency situation, there's no doubt that argument can be made. I have no doubt we can make the argument. Justice right now is an emergency situation, but we can't act that way, because burning ourselves out will ultimately help no one. So, the Dallas Park Keene team I spoke of earlier came up with a number of qualities that they warn us against. Busyness stresses our social fabric, robbing us of the time for reflection we need to do the work. Consumerism steals our focus. Cynicism sentences us to despair. Now, I hesitate to use their word tribalism because it gives tribes a bad name. Their point in this, though, is that even back in 1996, we were increasingly retreating into fortified enclaves defined by profession, lifestyle, ethnicity, or region, age, or class. When the lines become so hard that we can no longer talk to each other, we lose the common square and discover that the common good has been eroded. They contend that all of these strategies, all of these qualities, busyness, consumerism, cynicism, tribalism, grow out of the root of individualism, the myth that independence and individual rights save us. Rather, what we need is commitment to the common good, not to the good of a particular group, those like me, to a particular religious stance, my God above all others, or even to a particular nation, America first. These limited loyalties are idolatries. That's my language, not theirs. It's setting up false gods. Rather, we have to find the best for everyone, the common good. Not that that's easy to find. So part of what we have to do is find creative answers beyond the old liberal and conservative divide. Now, I know that can sound weak in times like now. I know that many of us are about the fight, defeating those we see as enemies. And I'm saying something really tough here. Our vision of the common good has to include everyone. That means that part of what I believe is that even though people with privilege may have something to lose, they will have more to gain in a world with a common good than they have in a world devoted to self-interest. They may not believe that, but I have to. And I say that knowing that I am someone with a good deal of privilege, particularly on a world scale, and that that may mean that I have to sacrifice some of that, whether it be in the form of money or energy or emotional strain. So the investigators I've been talking about interviewed an urban minister, Sarah Morgan, who answered a very hard question. Is there any way in which you work on behalf of even those whom you oppose? Is there any way in which you work on behalf of even those you oppose? And she answered this way. If our collective call is not one that leads to justice and mercy, then there will be no peace. We will continuously be instruments of our own oppression and enable the oppression of others. People usually like to separate religion from life, but if my work can do anything of substance, it will be to make real for people the fact that they are inextricably bound, that one is the other, and that how we live reflects what it is we claim to believe. That means that if there is anyone in a lower class around, or anyone who is hungry or enslaved, then that's a reminder that we are in that state with them. So the common good has to include everyone, everyone. We have to find ways of inclusivity. So the study also quotes an entrepreneur who's integrating business with the common good, who says, the middle way is not a balance, nor is it a kind of compromise. It's a course that keeps in view competing aims, making money versus being kind, having a kick-ass attitude versus having patience. The middle way is not this way or that way, either or. It's one that integrates both. Integrating paradoxes on a day-to-day basis, like a boatman navigating a swirling river, you steer between analysis and intuition, goals of profit and social responsibility, hardball and softball. So I'm going to disagree just a little bit with that quote I just read you. I think that what that person is describing is a balance, not the balance of separate scales, but the balance of yin and yang that I talked about last week, where opposites enfold and contain one another rather than pushing each other apart. And this is the kind of balance we have to do to maintain social justice work. The work's not added on, competing with our other commitments, but working with those commitments. And I'll say more in a moment about how we do that, because you're probably wondering. But first, back to the team, the Dallas Park Keene team. They describe several qualities found in individuals who are dedicated to work for the common good over many years in time. Most of them they expected to find. Things like commitment, courage, conviction, community, and compassion. And I'd like to focus on just two of these, community and compassion. If we are talking about working for a common good, which is what we must do if we want to make justice, then we cannot do it alone. We not only have to have community, we have to welcome others into that community to find out their vision of the common good, to come to know their needs, to encounter ever-increasing circles of connection. We need mentors, and we need to become mentors. We need colleagues, and we need to become colleagues. We need supporters, and we need to support. The study says that virtually everyone spoke of the importance of partners, kindred spirits, who share and help sustain the work. They may be family members, friends, former schoolmates, professional colleagues, or members of the same religious community. Often geographically dispersed, they are linked by mail, telephone, meetings, common projects, email. Today we'd add video conference and social media. But most of all, by a connection of heart and mind. As one person put it, they are the people you call or sometimes just think about. When you're down, when you're up, when you're just trying to muddle through, they provide perspective, comfort, advice, challenge, and most of all, the confirmation that one is not alone in the sometimes bone-aching, heart-weary commitment to the new commons. As Jessica's joy this morning said, Friday night and all day yesterday, six of us spent at Shawnee Mission UU Church, beginning engagement with Beloved Conversations, a structured program for encountering race and racism and striving to make a difference in our lives, in our congregation, and in our community around the issue of racial justice. Being together with more than 40 UUs from Kansas and Kansas City, Missouri, who are engaged in this work, did provide perspective, comfort, advice, challenge, and certainly the confirmation that we are not alone. You cannot do effective and lasting social justice work in isolation. You have to have a commitment to others with whom you work, a household, a work team, an organization, a religious group, maybe even this religious group. You have to have community. So, compassion is the other quality I want to hone in on. The investigators came across one surprising finding, something they found consistently across lives of people who worked long and hard for the common good. They all had what the investigators called a constructive, enlarging engagement with the other. So we as human beings need to have a community in which we're embedded. We as activists need to have community to support us in the work of doing justice. And at least as important, though, we have to have engagement with people who are different from us. Here is one way of thinking about it. Catholic theologian Ronald Marston has suggested justice is a matter of who is included and who is excluded. Justice is a matter of who and what we can tolerate neglecting. Who and what we can tolerate neglecting. Ow, that hurts. If we are unwilling to engage with otherness, we cannot do the work of real justice because we're neglecting someone. So instead, we encounter them. And in doing so, we come to feel a connection. And out of that connection grows compassion. The compassion may be tinged with pain. It may be accompanied by a sense of marginalization at times. It will be challenged by disagreement and anger. When we engage with the other, with any other, we are no longer in control of strategy or vocabulary or priorities. Ultimately, though, we are better by drawing a larger circle and allowing compassion to win out over our selfish needs. So I promised you some how-tos. How to integrate the work for justice into your other commitments. These are advisory and invitational and partially borrowed again from the Parks Dallas Keene team. So you have a commitment to your household. One of the most important things you can do for justice is to be sure that your household is just, that everyone counts, that everyone cares about each other's needs, that parents model working for justice and encourage and support their children in doing so. You model working toward the common good in your own home and introduce different people so that children have early encounters with diversity. You have a commitment to your profession or your job. You can work for justice within that organization. Is everyone there paid fairly? Are decisions made fairly? Is the workforce diverse? Obviously, you can't make those changes all by yourself. You can notice, though, and make alliances with others and create change in whatever way you can, taking power wherever you can. You have a commitment to the place you live and the governments that make policy for states, for the city, for the county, for the nation. How do you see common concerns aired? Where do you see constructive dialogue taking place? How are you involved with public decision making? How are you engaged with people in that community who are different from you, so you know what their needs are? How can you help bring commitment to the common good into your own efforts at citizenship? The start is thinking about these questions. So you have commitments, too, to businesses you use and nonprofits you relate with. How do they relate to the common good? How can you encourage and grow their commitment to the common good? Wherever you are, and this is particularly true for educators, and we might have a few of them here, but it applies to everyone. You want to be a model of fairness, of justice. You want to engage with difference and help others do the same. Be embedded in community and commit to encountering diversity with compassion and curiosity rather than judgment and negligence. So, in closing, I offer this short meditation from Taoist Dang Ming Dao. Take a deep breath. Worry is a problem that seems to be rampant. Perhaps it is due to the nature of our overly advanced civilization. Perhaps it is a measure of our own spiritual degeneracy. Whatever the source, it is clear that worry is not useful. It is a cancer of the emotions, concern gone compulsive. It eats away at body and mind. It does not do good to say, "Don't think about it. You'll only worry more." It is far better to keep walking your path, changing what you can. The rest must be dissolved in compassion. In this world of infants with immune deficiencies, racial injustice, economic imbalance, personal violence, and international conflict, it is impossible to address everyone's concerns. Taking care of yourself and doing something good for those whom you meet is enough. That is compassion. And we must exercise it even in the face of overwhelming odds. Whenever you meet a problem. Help if it is in your power to do so. After you have acted, withdraw and be unconcerned about it. Walk on. Then there is no worry because there has been action. So may it be. Our closing hymn is number 125, From the Crush of Wealth and Power. Of Kathleen McTeague, we breathe the common wind of the earth no matter where we live, who we love, what language we speak. We drink the common water of the earth no matter the color of our skin, how long we live, the covering we drape on our forms. We follow the common paths of the earth. No matter our beliefs, how far we move from home, the gold that we carry or its lack, may we live these truths, our hearts open to the holiness all around us, our hands turned always toward the common good. Amen.